starting with Wendell Berry because he's probably the most accessible. He's the least far out of these authors. You'll see some of them are pretty outrageous in some ways. But I think of Berry as a modern day Jeffersonian. He's taking the vision that Thomas Jefferson had for this country over 200 years ago and bringing it back to our awareness. And we'll talk about why that is, which makes him kind of comfortable, right? Because Jefferson is certainly an important part of our cultural heritage. So that's not going too far out on the limb. Berry can also be associated with a group that was writing in the 1930s that has come to be known as the Southern Agrarians. Robert Penn Warren and John Crow Ransom and people like that. Now, Berry is not one of them, and you have to be a little careful there because they were talking about the glories of the South, all the great values that Southern culture was based on in contradiction to industrial, commercial, competitive civilization, which the North represented. They didn't talk very much about the racial heritage of the South, which is a huge gap. And that's why I don't want to associate Berry too closely with them, because you can't just brush that under the rug. Berry does have things to say about race. So we should not think of him as simply a nostalgic Southerner. But he does have a lot in common with this Southern agrarian critique of the commercial capitalist system that won the Civil War. All right, so here's a short biography of Wendell Berry. Here's who he is. He was born in 1934 in Henry County, Kentucky, which is in the northern Kentucky near the Ohio River. His father was a lawyer, but they were rural people. They lived on a farm. He went to the University of Kentucky at Lexington for his BA and MA in English, and from an early age wanted to be a writer. So he graduated and he went off to Europe. That's what great writers do, right? You gotta go absorb the culture of Europe. And I think he was there about a year or so. And then he applied for a Wallace Stegner Fellowship at Stanford. Wallace Stegner was mentoring young writers, and Berry was accepted into the group and was with people like Ken Kesey, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and some other very impressive writers were in this circle around Stegner. So Berry was with them at Stanford for, again, I think about a year. And then he went to New York City, which is, again, where if you want to be a great writer, you got to live in New York, right? So he went there, he taught at NYU for a short while, and then he had his epiphany. I don't know exactly how old he was, but somewhere in his mid-20s. He's still only about 26, 27 at this point. And he said, I need to go home. I don't want to be a rootless New York-based writer just talking about intellectual things. I want to go back home and write about the place that I know. So he went back to Henry County, a town called Port Royal, and settled on the farm that was in his family, and he became a farmer. This is the late 1950s, and he has remained on his farm ever since. He is a working farmer, and much of his writing reflects that and talks about agricultural questions and the kinds of decisions that he has to make with his land and against the agribusiness industry, the agricultural universities. He has a lot to say about all that. That's his root. He started writing fiction, and his first novel was called Nathan Coulter, C-O-U-L-T-E-R, came out in 1960. He has since written 14 more novels and a whole lot of short stories. They've been collected in several works. And most, if not almost all of them, are based in a little town called Port Royal. No, I'm sorry. He lives in Port Royal. His stories take place in Port William, Kentucky, which is a fictional version of Port Royal. And he has this this term, he calls his characters the Port William membership. Because for him, membership in community is the most important thing to emphasize. He's always talking about how people's identities and their lives and their potentials are shaped by each other, their membership in a closely knit community. So all of his fiction addresses that.
Like David Budbill and Judah.
In one of his essays where he mentions Budbill, I think Budbill wrote to him and they corresponded for a while. Yeah, there's definitely an affinity there. Barry is also a poet, and he has published more than 30 volumes of poetry. He just keeps, this is while he's farming full time, and he cranks out these books. So I might read one of his poems later, probably not today, but it's beautiful poetry. For me, as a historian and as a cultural thinker, while his poetry and fiction are important and they reflect his thinking, it's his essays that really express his critique of our civilization. And again, he has written more than 30 collections of essays. So you add all this up, that this is over 70 books that he's published since 1960, and they're still coming out. So his first book of essays was The Long-Legged House in 1969. But they many, many others, and they have wonderful titles. One of his books has the best title of anything I've ever seen. It's called What Are People For? I love that one. He's won numerous prizes. In 2012, the National Endowment of the Humanities selected him to give the Jefferson Lecture in the Humanities at the Kennedy Center. That's a huge honor. And he is an activist. He goes to protests. He spent many years protesting against strip mining in Kentucky, and he's involved in climate change work, and I actually got to hear him speak in D.C. a few years ago. So he's got a very full life and he's an amazing writer. So let's get into what he says. What I'm going to do here, because it's impossible to go through all of his books and try to summarize them, I'm going to try to identify the key themes, like what are the big ideas in his work that sort of go through all of his writings, and I'll identify those and then talk a little bit about each one. And again, please jump in anytime something strikes you. So here's a quote that I think captures his essential position. Our fundamental problem is world destruction, caused by an irreconcilable contradiction between the natural world and the engineered world of industrialism. Industrial destructiveness is our disease. Most of our popular worries, climate change, fossil fuel addiction, pollution, poverty, hunger, and the various forms of legitimated violence, are symptoms. So that's the end of the quote. Let's just stop there. Is he right about that? Is there an irreconcilable contradiction between the natural world and the engineering that the industrial world does? Is that irreconcilable, or it's a little more subtle than that? Maybe there are ways that we can design a human world, a manufactured world, but still be in harmony with nature.
Of course you can do that.
Authors are wrestling with this. Yeah. This is a common thing, and I'm going to say we're not done with the Luddites.
Sure.
We're going to hear more about that. Well, let me go on. Another quotation. Barry says the Industrial Revolution, quote, has proceeded from the beginning with only two purposes: to replace human workers with machines and to market its products, regardless of their usefulness or their effects, at the highest possible profit, and so to concentrate wealth into ever fewer hands. The industrial economy, from agriculture to war, is by far the most violent the world has ever known, and we are all complicit in its violence. A society dominantly industrial has no effective means either of democratizing the gains or ameliorating the human costs of industrialization. How about that?
Bingo.
Bingo? And people killed wholesale, that's something new, that's more destructive than what people could do with spears and bows and arrows. I think that's, like many of these other authors, is asking us, how might that happen? How might we have technology that's, to use the phrase from the 1970s, appropriate technology, or human scale, or ecologically sensible? Can we have technology that doesn't destroy the ecosystem and that doesn't displace and impoverish workers? I think that's what he's asking. And I don't think he gives specific answers, like this is what it would look like. He really doesn't. He's asking the question. All right, another point he makes related to this, and this is not a direct quote, I'm paraphrasing. He says that industrialism or the consumerism, that's the flip side of that, and that's where he says we're all complicit in this, because we all buy the products that the factories are making. It masks the true biological, ecological, and social costs of the things we use. As consumers, we don't see the damage that is caused in the production of things. They happen far away somewhere, different part of the world, or they're going to happen to succeeding generations. We're damaging the environment in ways that will have much more impact in the future than we see now. So we don't take responsibility for our consumption because we have no relationship to the land that's used, the resources that are used, or to those who are producing. He says we're ignorant of or oblivious to everything about production except price. If we can buy things at a better price, we go for it. That's what we're conditioned to do in this system. Now, of course, there's a whole movement now of socially responsible consumerism, right? Fair trade and a lot of responses to that. And maybe this is a way that the system is starting to change. But Barry is saying that as it was set up, the worldview that gave rise to this system separates us from that kind of responsibility. He says we don't personally participate in extractive industries. Probably none of us have run an oil derrick at any point or a fracking operation. But that we are ignorantly dependent on them. We just, maybe not people in this room, but in general, we don't care how the things are made. We just want to have our goods and our luxuries. Barry argues that we have allowed industrialism to measure its success according to its own narrow standards. So as long as things are efficient and we get a better price and companies are making a profit, that's it. The system's working. Everything's just fine. We don't need to think about ecological damage or social disharmony. Those economists call those externalized costs. And Barry and these other authors will have a lot to say about that. Any comment or question on any of that? We'll add this up and see what you think. All right, here's a direct quote. For a long time now, we have understood ourselves as traveling toward some sort of industrial paradise, some new Eden conceived and constructed entirely by human ingenuity, and we have thought ourselves free to use and abuse nature in any way that might further this enterprise. Now we face overwhelming evidence that we are not smart enough to recover Eden by assault. He acknowledges that industrialism has raised our living standards, it has lengthened our lifespan. Right? There are benefits to this modern system. But then he asks, do these represent a net gain? Like, what have we given up in order to have the kind of health and longevity and comfort that we enjoy? What do we give up? And he talks about community, family, and the land itself, the soil, the water. We have sacrificed these in order to obtain those other goods. And he says, apart from its own highly specialized standards of quantity and efficiency, technological progress, and he puts that in quotation marks, has produced a social and ecological decline. Industrial war is worse than war used to be. Industrial agriculture diminishes everything it affects. Industrial workmanship is certainly worse than traditional workmanship. The ameliorations of technology are largely illusory. They are always accompanied by penalties that are equal and opposite. He's being maybe deliberately provocative here, right? He's saying that the benefits we get from our civilization, and I mean, think of the latest medical intervention you've had that made your life better or maybe saved your life. I recently had an atrial fibrillation corrected. Right? We don't want to give that up, right? But he's saying that the penalty that we pay for that is always equal. It's whatever good we get is balanced out by the destruction. So that's a little provocative, right? Do we really want to say that it's always a trade-off? Maybe not. But he wants us to think about what is the price. It's another point, and we're still on this general theme of looking at industrialism as a whole, as a system, and finding it lacking. Here's another aspect of that. He does talk about Jefferson occasionally, and what Jefferson's vision for a democratic society was. Jefferson believed that, you've seen these quotes, that the farmer, the self-sufficient farmer is the backbone of a democratic society because they're independent, they can take care of themselves, they're producers, and that a society Jefferson was very concerned about the working classes that he saw in Europe, the impoverished masses, and he said you can't have a democratic community if we become that kind of society. And Barry is endorsing that. He's saying that because we buy everything we need and we're unable to produce for ourselves, we no longer have skills to make things. We can't meet our own needs. He says this has led to a society characterized by degrading urban poverty and an equally degrading affluence, a society of undisciplined abundance. I love that phrase, undisciplined abundance, which is to say a society of waste. So there's another aspect. He believes that the current global capitalist system is really an outgrowth of centuries of colonialism, that now we have corporations colonizing other parts of the world, just as the nations of Europe previously did. But he says we are reaching a point where we're starting to see that the resources that industrialism depends upon, starting with petroleum, but some of the rare metals and other resources, we're seeing the possible end point where they're no longer abundant enough to keep the system going. There's a whole literature on peak oil, and Barry doesn't use that term, but we'll be revisiting that. But there is this awareness that these are finite resources. There's an end to them, and you cannot have unlimited economic growth on a finite planet. I'll get to you in a second. So he says that as we see this, we will realize that the endless expansion is not possible. There will be a crisis for industrialism, and the worldview or the ethical view that supports it, which he thinks is basically greed, will have to give way to a more communal way of organizing society, because we will have to share resources instead of hoarding them the way we do now. Consume as much as we want, because the earth will provide, and we're so clever. That he says that's really the ultimate problem. Okay, go on.
Yes.
Got 35 minutes to get. We're doing okay.
I'm getting
a second major theme in his work. Once you look at the critique of industrialism, now you turn to agriculture, and he says that agriculture and culture are intimately related. So the kind of society that we believe in, the kind of worldview that motivates us, will show up in how we use the land, and then vice versa. How we use the land will affect what we think, how we believe. Barry is probably best known for his work on this and as an early proponent of local food systems. He was a very early critic, like going back to the 60s, of industrialized agriculture and processed food and not being locally self-sufficient. And so his writings have been a big influence on this local food movement, which has, especially here in Vermont, has grown by leaps and bounds.
We've got to see tomorrow. It ties.
So he says that industrial agriculture, like all of industrial process, is only focused on production, on measuring, or as you say, cost benefit, right? Measuring with the best efficiency, the best profit that you can get, regardless of the damage that it does, which can be externalized. So Monsanto or Cargill or all these big agribusinesses, they don't have to pay for the destruction of soil. As long as the farmers keep buying their product, they don't really have to care about that, because somewhere down the road, someone else will have to pay for it, whether we run out of food because the soil is dead, or climate change, or species dying off, whatever it is. But Monsanto and other corporations don't pay that cost. It's externalized. Barry says that this type of agriculture removes the farm from having any kind of ecological relationship to the land. And he gives the example of the straight rows that are planted, and you have the tractors and going back and forth on these long rows. Well, that's fine for some places in Iowa and Nebraska or whatever, but the industrial mindset says, well, this is the best practice. This is the most efficient technique. This is what you should do. And he says land has infinite qualities. So the contours of the land, the type of soil, the moisture, the other organisms that live there, each require a different approach. And sometimes you don't want straight rows. You want contours, and sometimes you don't till at all. I mean, I'm not going to get into the details of agriculture here, but again, he's basically contrasting a mechanistic approach, which is one size fits all, against an organic approach, which says you pay attention to the land, to the organisms that are in front of you. He points out that the companies that are making fertilizer, synthetic fertilizer, and pesticides, insecticides, that's the same thing. They were making war material during World War II. They were making explosives and poisons and horrible things. And the chemistry of those substances is not all that different from fertilizer and pesticides. So they just converted products. So Barry calls this a war against the living world. And in this war, the enemy is anything that does not provide efficiency or profit. So if you can stamp out bugs and raise your yields temporarily, that's what you do. And then here's a phrase that he uses, which I've seen on posters and in food co-ops and such. And he says, eating is an agricultural act. So he tells us not to be passive consumers, not to just accept the produce of this industrial agriculture system. This is a quote, "How we eat determines to a considerable extent how the world is used." He would like us to have a more conscious relationship to our food. He says, the pleasure of eating real food allows us to experience and celebrate our dependence and our gratitude, for we are living from mystery, from creatures we did not make and powers we cannot comprehend.
That's a good one.
He's going to say a lot more about this, about mystery, about our ignorance. We'll get to that later. But the point is that he's making is that if we have an attitude of reverence and respect for the land, accept that it's much more complex than we can possibly know, we'll have a different kind of agriculture and we'll eat differently than if we attack the land and produce things according to some specification where we feel like we're in charge, we're the masters. That's the attitude that he's trying to get past here. The themes in his work. Another theme then is this ecological ethic. We'd call it an ethic, where he really wants us to see the world, see the natural world as a complex, interdependent system that we need to respect, and we need to understand how to live in it without dismembering it. He says modern agriculture is based on the assumption, quote, that the human will is sovereign in the universe, that the only laws are the laws of mechanics, and that the material world and its natural resources, in quotation marks, are without limit, and thus we attempt to conquer nature. So that's the attitude that he's really, really criticizing at the base of all his work. And then he makes the point that no matter how powerful we are, no matter how much we can manipulate nature and wipe out insects and weeds and fungus, and you know, we think we can produce all this great amount of food because we're so in charge of what's happening. He says, in the long run, we can less afford the losses than nature can. Ultimately, nature will win this war. Because if our war against nature destroys the health of water and soil, and thus inevitably the health of agriculture and our own health, and can only lead to our economic ruin, then we need to try another possibility, which he says is living in harmony and cooperation with nature. Man, and excuse this sexist language, he probably wrote this 40 years ago and didn't know any better, man cannot be independent of nature. In one way or another, he must live in relation to it, and there are only two alternatives. The way of the frontiersman, whose response to nature was to dominate it, to assert his presence by destroying it, or the way of Thoreau, who went to the natural places to become quiet in them, to learn from them, to be restored by them. That's the end of the quote. So Barry is saying that we need to cultivate that kind of reverence of seeing nature as a teacher, as a restorative, even a spiritual force. It's not something that we can manipulate and make and bend to our will and come out in good shape at the other end.
So Ron, would you say that Barry...
The crisis that we're in, I think what Barry and all of these others are saying is that because we identify ourselves that way in industrial civilization, that we are the masters, we are the smart ones who can control nature for our benefit as we define it, it's because of that underlying belief that we're in the mess we're in. So that the way out of it is to think differently, is to see ourselves differently. And like I said before, Barry doesn't sketch out what a utopian world would look like, but if we can go back to that ultimate question of who are we, why are we here, and come up with a different answer, we will have a different society. I think in his fiction he does explore that vision of this is what it could look like, or this is what it did look like in rural communities before they were damaged. So this sense of reverence and respect for nature, throughout his writings, he's talking about virtues that we need to cultivate. So if we see ourselves differently, how do we do that? What virtues, what qualities would we cultivate? And I've put together a list of words that I found in different writings. He doesn't list them all in one place, but he talks about self-restraint, moderation. Should I go slowly if you're writing them all down? Self-restraint, moderation, thoughtfulness, patience, fidelity.
Did you say fidelity?
Fidelity, yeah. Being loyal or true to your community or to your piece of land, your place on earth. That's another title of one of his books that I love, A Place on Earth. So fidelity, affection. We're almost done. Caretaking, kindness, here's the longest word, neighborliness. And respect for culture. We'll talk about what that means.
Wendell Berry have a family.
He emphasizes family very, very much in his writings. So this list of virtues, you could look at it and say, well, it's essentially religious. These are the kinds of things that a religion tries to get us to be like. Or you could say it's fundamentally conservative. This is what someone like William Bennett and his Book of Virtues that came out, 30 years ago, wants us to be like. And I think Barry would not run from those characterizations. He's not overtly religious in his writing, but he doesn't shy away from it. And some of the writers who have interpreted his work have said that Barry is essentially a religious thinker. He's trying to bring us back to that kind of moral self-restraint, kindness, right? Fidelity. These are not necessarily, but they can be very closely associated with a religious sensibility. And what he means by respect for culture, this ties him back to those southern agrarians, because that's what they emphasize, that the problem with modernity, with industrialization, is we're always trying to improve. We're always innovating. We're always making things better. One of the theorists of capitalism you'll know this, it's not Ricardo, but it, one of them talks about creative destruction. Mm-hmm. Who was that?
Friedman, maybe. I don't know.
Well, he would agree, but all of them would agree with that, right? Yeah. That's what's great about capitalism, is that you're always tearing down because you're going to build something better. And this worldview, whether it's Barry specifically, or religious, or the Southern agrarian conservatism, says, wait, not so fast. Look at what you're doing when you destroy. You might think you're bringing in something better, but look what you're losing. And you have to be faithful to the generations that came before you, who knew what this land could do, who knew what was like to live in this community. You don't just come in and sweep it all away. So that's so Barry is not a neoconservative. He's not a gung-ho capitalist conservative when we think of that term. But he's an old-fashioned, he's a paleoconservative. And he's saying, let's conserve what's good, what has proven itself over generations. And indeed, this next quote, I think, reflects that. He shows that he's not what we think of as a modern conservative. When property rights become absolute, they are invariably destructive, for then they are used to justify not only the abuse of things of permanent value for the temporary benefit of legal owners, but also the appropriation and abuse of things to which the would-be owners have no rights at all. The atmosphere, the water cycle, wilderness, ecosystems, the possibility of life. This is made worse when great corporations are granted the status of persons who can then also become rugged individuals. So he's no friend of corporate America here. But I would suggest that he is a conservative in that old-fashioned way of virtue and respect for tradition and culture and family and community. I should pause there. Any two more quick themes? I've mentioned this already, but let's mark it as an essential part of Barry's thought, and that's humility, that recognizing our ignorance, recognizing that we cannot know the world in its entirety. And if you have an ecological view and you realize how complex and interconnected everything is, then you're going to be humble in the face of that. He says there will always be gaps in our knowledge. There will always be incompleteness or error. We need to act with care because partial knowledge gives much destructive power. We must learn to acknowledge that the creation is full of mystery. We will never entirely understand it. We must abandon arrogance and stand in awe. We must recover the sense of the majesty of creation and the ability to be worshipful in its presence. For I do not doubt that it is truly on the condition of humility and reverence before the world that our species will be able to remain in it. In another passage, he says, ignorance, arrogance, narrowness of mind, incomplete knowledge, and counterfeit knowledge, which we seem to have more of these days, are of concern to us because they are dangerous. They cause destruction. When united with great power, they cause great destruction. The present, this one is key, I like this sentence. The present problems of the world are the result not of human stupidity, but of human intelligence without adequate cultural controls. So arrogance. There is, again, another quote, there is an ominous, perhaps a fatal presumptuousness in living in a place by the imposition on it of one's ideas and wishes. And that is the way we white people have lived in America throughout our history, and it is the way our history now teaches us to live here.
Can you repeat that one?
So humility, do you know where the term What's the Latin or root of humility?
Human?
I think human also comes from the root. It's humus. This is the soil. Right? Ashes to ashes and dust to dust is another way of saying that. So if you have humility, you realize that you are of the earth. You're not above it. You're not something special. So Barry explicitly refers to humans as creatures. We are creatures like all the other animals and plants. And again, this gets back to Derek Jensen. That's a point he's making. We owe our lives to the gifts of creation. So here's a quote from a scholar named Regan Sutterfield talking about Barry's work. Barry wants to see human life as entangled in the life of the whole creation, free from the tendency among some to see the creation as some mere terrarium-like landscape made purely for human use and entertainment. So this is the opposite of an anthropocentric worldview. It's a humble worldview. Humility is an acceptance of limits, an embrace of reality and of nature as it is, without our having to manipulate it. It's an acceptance of the web of life within which we exist. This is something Barry emphasizes a lot. Okay, one last theme, and then maybe we'll have 3 minutes to wrap up and discuss things. He talks about the danger of abstraction. So he wants our language to be true to experience, very much like George Orwell in 1984. He warns against using abstract or language or jargon to mask or to camouflage unpleasant realities. One of his books, in fact, is called Standing by Words, that your words should express concrete realities. Abstraction allows us to overlook the individuality of a place, of a piece of land, or the individuality of a community, or of individuals. If we stick to our ideology, if we are only looking at the financial worth of something, because that's very abstract, right? We put a price on something. What does that mean? It's totally abstract. If we categorize things, we diminish the inherent value of and the uniqueness of people and places. He argues that scientific expertise by itself cannot substitute for an intimate relationship with a place, that a person who lives in a place and is attentive to the cycles of nature there will know that place better than a scientist who measures the rainfall or the carbon content or whatever. That by measuring you don't get to the essence of things. Now he's not anti-scientific, but he doesn't want science to substitute for that intimate knowledge. Emerson, in one of his essays, says something about that as well, although Barry isn't quoting Emerson. So industrialism, as we've seen, is a mechanistic worldview, that things are machine-like, they're predictable, you can tinker with them, you can manipulate them to serve your ends, and Barry doesn't want us to see the world in a mechanistic way. He wants this organic, in a way it's a vulnerable way of being in the world, right? You allow yourself to be moved by your experience rather than trying to manipulate it all the time. And he talks about how medicine, and again we can argue about this, but the field of medicine and politics in general use categories. They use abstract ideas which can't apply to everybody in the same way, that you need to take account of the individual and the community and the place in all of its uniqueness. And I'm going to stop there.